realize the significance of the Holy Prophet's instructions.
Okay.
The being who was considered a calamity by her mother and a disgrace for her father, unfortunately, when daughters were buried alive, the Holy Prophet established her love in the hearts of parents. Moreover, he expressed that daughters equally deserve our kindness and affections as sons do. By him having a daughter,
yeah.
Hazrat Fatima Zahra, and how he used to stand up for her.
It's like they were, everybody used to wait for the Prophet to get children, and the first thing he got was a daughter. And how much he cherished her. And it was those times where people were very, you know, jahil about, the ignorant about the fact that daughters have such a great station in reality.
And Allah tells them, "Inna shaniyaka huwal abtar."
Yeah.
Your tails are cut off.
Subhanallah.
Don't think this woman would bring the generation forward. And that's when we get this Ahlul Bayt who are
from
so
heart.
Rich for us, right?
Definitely, yeah. Subhanallah, inshallah, that we are able to, you know, emulate and try and work on ourselves as well as on our children, inshallah. And unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. And thank you so much for enlightening us on this beautiful topic, on these beautiful ahadith. Inshallah, till the next time, dear audience, thank you very much for listening. Fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the Messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
European News Bulletin.
From London, hello everyone. My name is Saeed Purusa. Our top story. BioNTech and Pfizer, the first in the race to produce evidence of a working COVID-19 vaccine, say they're planning to differentiate pricing of the drug among countries and regions. The European Commission says the bloc has signed a deal for up to 300 million doses of the experimental drug. The Spanish Health Ministry says it's in the queue for 20 million doses, enough to immunize 10 million people. News that sparked fresh hopes in the country, one of the worst hit in Europe, recording more than 1.3 million cases as of today. In the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced his country ordered more than 40 million doses, but warned people against relying on the news as a solution. BioNTech and Pfizer say their vaccine has shown more than 90% efficacy, a major breakthrough in the fight against the pandemic. Let's discuss that story with physician and surgeon Ranjit Barar. Dr. Barar, it's good to have you with us. So what do we know about this vaccine? Is it the silver bullet we've all been waiting for?
Good to be with you. Obviously, everyone's encouraged whenever there's any medical development, so I should say that to begin with. That said, you know, the data we have is still very early and very patchy, Saeed. So we're talking about the first interim analysis in what is a trial with large numbers, but at the moment the numbers on which this analysis is based is just 90 people. So we're not talking about a trial that's really much larger in its information than that which was ridiculed by our media when we talked about the Sputnik vaccine. So 90 people, 90% efficacy, 10% of people, therefore, who've had the vaccine, though they've not published the precise endpoints and trial data, just made an announcement from the company, 10% of people who have the vaccine still get the disease, and we don't know how badly they get it. There is such a thing as antibody-mediated enhancements, so it's possible, but the safety data, which is not published, won't support the use of the vaccine. So it is incredible to see the scale on which it's being manufactured and bought based on this very limited evidence. Clearly, COVID is a world health emergency, and people are looking for every way of solving it. But at the moment, we're projected to have 50 million doses this year, but 1.3 billion manufactured next year. And our own vaccine czar, who's been appointed by Boris Johnson, actually a venture capitalist rather than a physician, has been instrumental in buying up this experimental drug, as you quite rightly say. I'm hopeful that it worked. At the moment, the evidence is very much not there to fully support that conclusion.
And apart from that, there is the process of the government here or the medical world here proving the efficacy of the vaccine and then licensing it, and also the task of making sure everybody in the population gets the jab. That's straight from Matt Hancock, the health secretary. How long will this process take before people actually get the vaccination?
So it's still questionable to me whether this will be the final vaccine that goes to mass use. It's an experimental technology also in the fact that this is an RNA vaccine. RNA is an unstable compound. It's in all of our cells, but it's a synthesis of the RNA that will translate into a protein that corresponds to the spike protein on the virus. The other vaccines which are showing most promise to me are the fully inactivated virus, which is a protein used by two or three Chinese companies, and Russia's adenovirus vector vaccine, both of which the Russians also comes in a lyophilized version. So they can be used and stored at room temperature. This virus, this vaccine that we're talking about, the RNA vaccine from BioNTech, though it's an interesting new technology, will need to be stored at minus 80 degrees C. And if you're talking about distributing billions of doses worldwide, that's a huge logistical barrier that it places in the way. So again, it's not absolutely clear to me. While the share price undoubtedly is going through the roof on the basis of this announcement, it's not clear to me that they have crossed all the hurdles associated with really delivering this to the population.
And finally, there are lots of conspiracy theories about any future vaccines. Public trust is at an all-time low. What needs to be done to secure a way forward? Or do you think there is enough transparency over how, like, the process of manufacturing these vaccines?
Well, I think it's a really good question. I think I am in favor of vaccines in general as a technology, but of course all technologies need to be carefully developed and rigorously tested prior to rolling out. Clearly, the pandemic gives a situation of pressure that we want these results quickly. But once the interests of large companies and their profits come in the way, plus the interests of governments in dealing with things, then it becomes very opaque. And really, I would like to see the NHS taking the lead. But rather than that, so that's our publicly funded health system. But what we're seeing is that every juncture, our current administration are pushing vast sums of money, vast sums of capital, really, into the hands of their privately appointed cronies. And in the case of the vaccines, we're talking about someone called Kate Bingham, who is a venture capitalist rather than a clinician, who has a husband who is a Tory MP, who is announcing to the biotech industry which vaccines the British government will back and buy up. So there's a huge amount of commercialism which is not related to the efficacy. And all of this diminishes public trust, and it's likely to diminish public uptake. I'm hopeful that we will find a vaccine. Whether this is the one, that is not at all clear, and the process of acquisition and distribution is far from transparent and far from politically clean, in my opinion.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Ranjit Brar, an NHS consultant, physician, and surgeon. Appreciate talking to you, as always. To other news now. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has called for a new transatlantic alliance between the bloc and the U.S. The former German defense minister congratulated President-elect Joe Biden and his running mate Kamala Harris on their victory. She made no mention of outgoing President Donald Trump, who is yet to concede defeat.
We need strong institutions backed by strong commitment from member countries. Our international system has been held hostage for too many years now, so the time has come to reverse the trend, to reform those institutions that need reform, and to revive multilateral deals that are essential for our common security, to create new coalitions on the most pressing issues of our times.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have both spoken with President-elect Biden and offered him their support and congratulations. So, will there be a smooth transition of power from Trump to Biden? Well, Trump's Secretary of State thinks a transition won't be necessary, that Trump will prevail. Let's bring in Robert N. Lakesh. And Robert, what is Secretary Pompeo talking about?
Well, he's talking about a peaceful transition to another Trump administration, which is something interesting to many, as it does look at this time that Donald Trump has lost. Of course, Donald Trump is not accepting that. He's trying to push for recounts. He's trying to sue several different states, launch these legal complaints about so-called voter fraud, and so that's a prevailing theme that we hear from the Trump side. But something interesting from Mike Pompeo, being the Secretary of State, is that this guy, being a former CIA man as well, is that when the transition does happen, if the Trump administration is not going to accept it and Mike Pompeo is behind him, then the transfer of information from one administration to the other may be and may prove a difficult task. On top of this as well, one of the journalists during the press briefing, when Secretary Pompeo said what he said, asked, you know, how are we trying to tell other countries, you know, to follow a democratic process when, you know, for instance, in this scenario, Donald Trump and his administration don't want to follow that same model.
Exactly. And I think he called that question ridiculous three times, or maybe four. I'm sure people have had a lot to say about this.
Absolutely. The first comment we've got here says, poor slob. No one's told him Biden won. And a lot of people posing that question online. Has he even seen the news? And then on top of that here, we've got one commenting and saying, Pompeo is a bona fide warmonger working for a man who needs a deal for his legacy. On another note, Biden has not proven himself to be anti-war. Lots to worry about RE-US policy with Iran, regardless of who is in charge.
All right, let's stay with the American president again, Donald Trump, the gift that keeps on giving. As far as the Israeli prime minister is concerned, what's up with that?
Absolutely, and something that's been highlighted in the wake of the potential Biden presidency is that the Israeli army radio have actually been saying now, and the occupation of forces in general have been pushing for Netanyahu to get done annexation of the West Bank, which is something that he hasn't done up until this point. It was a campaign promise, however, because they do not believe, the occupation infrastructure does not believe that this can be achieved under Joe Biden, so they want to get it done now under Donald Trump. If that happens, this will pose a huge problem. Biden, you know, would have to be an extremely strong president to try and push back and reverse that. On top of that as well, we got the fact that Donald Trump now is trying to go after Iran even harder for Israel, and of course Netanyahu fearing that the United States will seek to get back into the JCPOA. So Donald Trump is putting on the table perhaps sanctions on a near weekly basis against Iran, new sanctions to try and cripple Iran, which of course amounts to a war crime in many instances. And on top of that as well, more aggressive policies are coming into place from the occupation. The Zionist entity itself has just declared thousands more new settlements to go ahead. Benny Gantz declared that himself, the Minister of War.
Right, and it is no secret, Robert, that Biden is also a great friend of Israel's. We'll have to see how he will operate when he takes the helms of power at the White House. The online reaction to this.
First one we have here is from an American journalist called Ben Norton. He says, neocon sociopath Mike Pompeo and war criminal Elliot Abrams are going to spend the last few months of the Trump administration trying to kill as many Iranians as possible with medieval siege warfare, with help from proxies Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. We got another one here as well who says, this is a crime. I don't think Biden is better. It's the system, not the person.
All right, Robert and Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. Moving on now. French President Emmanuel Macron says the threat of terrorism is a European reality that requires a rapid European answer.
Le terrorisme de Paris à Bruxelles.
Terrorism from Paris to Brussels to Berlin, Utrecht, London, Madrid, Barcelona, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Nice, and now Vienna, and a lot more. It's a European reality which we should bring a response to. That's why we need a common, coordinated, and quick response.
The French president also said Europe had to rethink its open border Schengen area and look into encouraging the training of imams in Europe. This weeks after he condemned what he called radical Islam and supported the republication of offensive Prophet Muhammad cartoons by satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, setting off mass protests across the Muslim world. Also in France, officials have reported multiple people wounded when an explosive device hit a ceremony commemorating the end of World War I at a ceremony in the Saudi Arabian city of Jeddah. Officials said that several countries had representatives at the ceremony held at a ceremony for non-Muslims. Wednesday marked the 102nd anniversary of the armistice ending World War I and is commemorated in several European countries. Last month, a security guard at the French consulate in Jeddah was stabbed. It's unclear if these attacks are in relation to the ongoing dispute over Islamophobia in France. After a lull in arms sales to Saudi Arabia, the UK government has processed a backlog of hundreds of sales applications. Rights groups say the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which has caused the worst humanitarian crisis of our times, is more than enough evidence of Riyadh's human rights abuses. Yet the British government begs to differ. Yanka Rahimi has more.
The death toll from the Saudi-led war on Yemen is in the hundreds of thousands. A quarter of all civilians killed in air raids are women and children. Roughly 20 million Yemenis are experiencing food insecurity, and at least half of those are at risk of famine. Saudi-led airstrikes hit schools, hospitals, and wedding parties indiscriminately. Britain sells billions of pounds worth of arms to Saudi Arabia, but sales were halted in June 2019 after a high court case brought by the Campaign Against Arms Trade ruled the sales were unlawful because ministers had failed to properly assess the risk of these weapons being used against civilians in Yemen. But the moratorium was lifted in July 2020 after International Trade Secretary Liz Truss announced a government review has concluded the potential for British-made weapons to be used to commit war crimes in the conflict was isolated and that there was little evidence of a pattern of Saudi airstrikes targeting civilians. Rights groups say that simply is not true.
The sales being approved today could be used to fuel abuses for years to come. The humanitarian crisis in Yemen is only getting worse. But Liz Truss and her colleagues are more concerned with boosting arms company profits than they are with the rights and lives of people in Yemen.
But are Yemeni rights and lives Westminster's priority? In 2016, when challenged by opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn over arms sales to Saudi Arabia, then Prime Minister Theresa May said this. Actually, what matters is the strength of our relationship with Saudi Arabia. When it comes to counter-terrorism and dealing with terrorism, it is that relationship that has helped to keep people on the streets of Britain safe. Anti-arms trade campaigners say the decision to process over 500 applications for arms sales to Saudi Arabia is simply immoral and have filed a case to challenge it yet again. Bianca Rahimi, London.
More than 2,000 African migrants have been stranded in a dockside camp on the Spanish island of Gran Canaria after a series of arrivals overwhelmed local authorities' capacity to house them. Across the islands, more than 2,600 people have arrived in 73 boats since Saturday, breaking all previous records. With reception centers across the islands stretched to capacity, some have been stuck on the dock for days. Seaborne migration to the Canaries, which lie around 100 kilometers off Morocco's west coast, has jumped tenfold this year, with some 15,500 people braving the perilous Atlantic crossing. Story one in this segment, a high-profile resignation of the Football Association in football country. Joining me to talk about that story, Richard Sudan. And Richard, tell us what brought the guy's downfall.
Well, so Greg Clark, in some comments made to a parliamentary select committee, basically made some comments, and he's been accused of racism, and he stepped down as a result. I think it's important to listen to what Greg Clark said himself, which led to the controversy. Let's take a listen.
If I look at what happens to high-profile female footballers, high-profile coloured footballers, and the abuse they take on social media, not from the crowds, because, you know, you get misbehaviour in crowds, but largely people have bought a season ticket, they're going to behave, because they will be banned for life if they keep giving racist or homophobic abuse. One, if I said it, I deeply apologise for it. Secondly, I am a product of having worked overseas.
I understand, Richard, this wasn't the first time he made those errors, in his opinion.
Indeed, it wasn't the first time. And actually, for anyone who hasn't been living on Mars, calling black people coloured is deeply offensive. It has been since I can remember. And of course, the reality is, if Greg Clark was the sort of manager at your local McDonald's, he should probably step down. But this is the chairman for the governing body, the Football Association in Britain. And of course, you heard in the words there of Greg Clark, as usual, when people make these comments, he offered some kind of excuse, which really isn't acceptable. What really beggars belief is that he actually said them in the first place. We're almost in 2021, and there's no excuse anymore for saying I didn't know or I come from a different time. These comments, this doesn't really serve as a justification. What does matter actually is the feelings of black people who want to be called black. It sounds a lot more equal than coloured. And of course, one more thing, the phrase coloured has a throwback really to the 50s and 60s and 70s in the UK, where it was used as a derogatory slur. And of course, it's also got a horrible throwback to Jim Crow, the segregation laws in the South in America, coloured fountains, coloured restaurants, etc., etc. So, of course, Clark has stepped down, but I think that was entirely predictable.
All right. Football fans, people who have been following this story, definitely have had a lot to say about this online.
Absolutely. Let's go first to Christine Stewart, who says, so Greg Clark has gone. I'm not totally convinced that he understands the racism inherent in the language he used. Meanwhile, may I beg you to think twice before using derogatory terms associated with disabled people too. They are all unacceptable. And Angolan Geordie says, Greg Clark from FA chairman to dinosaur in 5 hours. That was the fastest extinction ever.
All right. Let's move on to your second story, and this last one also takes us to the U.S. The last time we talked about your second story, Richard, it said that the leader of the extremist group, Proud Boys, had said that the standby order had been rescinded. Tell us what happened since.
Well, it seems that the white supremacist Proud Boys are making good on their promise to no longer stand by and to roll out. And it's led to the fact that they are planning to march on the nation's capital in the U.S., Washington, at the weekend, raising a lot of fear, a lot of concerns. Obviously, we know what their intents are. And one wonders what measures the government, the security services, are taking, because it came to light on a parlor social media conversation that they were planning to do this. But of course, there are many questions really raised about the potential collaboration between elements of the state and white militia groups like this. And so I think if you're black in America, if you're in Washington right now, this is deeply worrying. Many people do characterize the Proud Boys as a terrorist organization with a terrorist intent, malicious, harmful aims that they have. And so I think this is an extremely worrying concern for the weekend. You know, one would hope There isn't going to be bloodshed on the streets, but this is a very malicious group intent on one thing only. And so I think all eyes are going to be on Washington at the weekend, of course.
You said something, Richard, about collusion between these militia groups and elements of the state. Who are we talking about exactly?
Well, I think if you go online, there are plenty of videos, arguably, of various police forces across the country actually giving the OK signal and other such signals when these white supremacist rallies happen, basically allowing them to do what they do. Of course, you've got the cases of Ahmed Arbery, where many people would argue that the perpetrators of his killing were only allowed to roam free for so long because of a potential collaboration with the district attorney's office. So there are many levels, people are saying, to this potential collaboration. And so if you're reliant on the police forces and the security services to protect you at the weekend, there are many, many questions raised right now, Saeed. So these are extremely dangerous times for black Americans.
Would you say we're looking at probably some kind of a face-off or a confrontation between these militia groups and others who are also armed come this weekend?
Well, I think certainly the Proud Boys are intent on causing harm. I don't really think, in my opinion, there are other groups really that you can make an equivalence with them. Of course, Trump tried to do that. He tried to make an equivalence between the far right and elements of the left. Whatever you think about the organized left, quote unquote, in America, it's certainly not comparable to white supremacist terrorist groups that are very open, actually, about their malicious intent, Saeed.
All right. Bring us the online reaction to it.
Let's go to Gail, first of all, who says, I may just be paranoid, but Trump appears to be building a compound. He has created a militia. He can call to man that the Proud Boys, Stand Back and Stand By, are planning a million of them to march through Washington on Saturday night, Trump's last days. And the aptly named Antifa for Life says, so it's really happening. Real Donald Trump supporters from white supremacists and Proud Boys are coming to Washington. I wonder if the FBI and police are going to do anything about it. And actually, that's one of the big questions on everybody's lips. What exactly are the government going to do about this very, very serious threat?
All right. Trump has left his golf course, Richard, and it's at the Arlington Cemetery on Remembrance Day as we speak. Thank you very much, Richard Sudan, with those stories. And thank you, everybody. Goodbye from me and the team here in London.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the role of politeness in Islamic da'wah. Brothers and sisters, we all love to attract others towards Islam. Why? Because we see Islam to be that ultimate religion that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent for the guidance of humanity. Now, language plays an imperative role in the practice of Islamic da'wah, this invitation towards Islam. Delivering the da'wah in a polite and proper language and in accordance with the context is a requirement and a major factor for a successful da'wah presentation. this invitation towards Islam, a lot of it has to do with how you present Islam. Speech politeness has always been associated with the use of speech acts. There are several reasons why dawah should be delivered in a polite manner. Speech politeness in dawah has been regulated in the Quran in chapter Surah An-Nahl. And, it's verse number 125. This becomes the foundation of invitation towards Islam. In the Quran, there is an explanation of how should a Muslim speak. In brief, there are six principles of speech that are elaborated in Quran. Okay, so now, inviting others towards, non-Muslim towards Islam, is something encouraged in Islam. It's appreciated in Islam, right? And in some cases, it is mandatory, right? Now, you invite them through polite speech, through politeness, through akhlaq, right? Now, there are these six principles that we're going to lay out for you today that is going to outline the Islamic dawah infrastructure. Welcome back to your listeners. Before the break, we were discussing about dawah and invitation towards Islam and the role of politeness in this dawah. And we said that there are six principles introduced by Quran which are to be practiced while doing Islamic dawah. In brief, these six principles are, number one, qawlan sadidan. That is, speaking truthfully and honestly. Number two, speaking effectively with balagha, right? Number three, qawlan ma'rufan. That is, speaking kind words which are pleasing to the soul of the listener and instilling sense of peace in the heart. Number four, qawlan kariman. That is speaking noble words that encourages and brings joy. Number five, qawlan layyinan. That is speaking gentle words. And last but not the least is qawlan maysuran. That is speaking pleasant, appropriate, and understandable words. And all of these, this infrastructure that are laid in front of you, this is all in Quran. This is extracted straight from Quran. Okay? So these are the principles, the six basic principles through which Islamic dawah has to be performed. And this is where you see that politeness is very essential in our dawah and invitation activities. Many people converted to Islam because of the akhlaq and politeness of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scientists are figuring out the chemical triggers that turn the liquid stored in silk glands into solid that's tougher than Kevlar. Pound for pound, spider silk is stronger than steel and tougher than Kevlar. But it doesn't start out that way. What you just heard were words selected from an article under the heading, Spider Silk is Stronger Than Steel. It also assembles itself. The article has been written by Catherine J. Wu, who's a reporter for the New York Times, covering science and health issues. Stay with us for more of Catherine J. Wu's article. Scientists are figuring out the chemical triggers that turn the liquid stored in silk glands into a solid that's tougher than Kevlar. Pound for pound, spider silk is stronger than steel and tougher than Kevlar. But it doesn't start out that way. The silk starts out in a liquid form called dope. But in fractions of a second, this goopy liquid slurry of proteins is transformed, and it doesn't just turn into a solid. On their way out of a spider's bottom, the protein builds blocks in silk called spidroids, fold themselves and interlace, creating a highly organized structure without guidance from any outside forces. This remarkable process of self-assembly is about as strange as a garden hose spitting out a stream of perfect snowflakes. Scientists have spent years trying to mimic it in the hope that it will someday revolutionize the construction of ultra-strong, sustainable materials. You can really generate materials with unique properties by exploiting this self-assembly process, said Dr. Millay, a structural biologist and biochemist. Dr. Millay doesn't yet have the entire process figured out, neither does anyone else. But in a paper published in Science Advances, he and his colleagues lay out a new way to tackle the spider silk puzzle, mimicking its orderly exit from the spinneret with chemical tools in the laboratory. A crucial part of spinning, the researchers found, requires the spidroids to separate themselves from the watery buffer that swaddles them inside silk glands, a step that hyperconcentrates the proteins. An influx of acid then prompts the proteins to securely interlock. The metamorphosis spider silk must undergo as it exits an arachnid cannot be overstated, according to Dr. Anna Rising, a spider silk expert. Dr. Rising said, while still in the gland, spidroids have to stay suspended in a liquid form at really extreme concentrations. It's a viscous, almost like a toothpaste. If the silk hardens too soon, it could clog the spider's glands with a nightmarishly webby form of constipation. Too late, and the arachnid might spew only shapeless liquid. That makes both timing and efficiency central to the silk spinning process. Luckily for spiders, millenniums of evolution have made spidroids versatile. The proteins, Dr. Anna Rising explained, are structured like barbells. A long disorderly string capped on each end by a bolt-like blob. In the silk glands, these barbells are thought to naturally pair up at one end, creating V-shaped geodes that slosh around in the dope. To form the more stable architecture required of solid silk, the spidroins need to link up in chains using the other ends of the barbells. That seems to happen under the influence of a couple of chemical cues, said Jessica Garb, a spider silk researcher at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, who was not involved in the study. As the spidroin slurry is extruded through a labyrinth of increasingly narrow ducts, the spider cells pump acid into the mixture, making the freed ends of the barbell stick together. The journey through these tapering tubes also tugs and squeezes the silk into its final form. Dr. Malay and his colleagues found that this sculpting and self-assembly could not happen if the liquid spidroins weren't dehydrated as they moved through the spider's anatomy. Further experiments showed salts made the proteins rapidly distance themselves from the liquid surrounding them, like oil and vinegar in a salad dressing. This allows the spidroins to more easily interact, said Cheryl Hayashi, a spider silk researcher at the American Museum of Natural History, who wasn't involved in the study. Freshly thickened, the stew of spidroins then shapes itself into an increasingly stringy structure. The silk extrusion pipeline might sound a bit cumbersome, but an engineer's perspective, though, it's an extraordinarily elegant. Scientists can build super strong polymers in the laboratory through brute force, coercing materials to come together in ways they otherwise wouldn't. But given the right ingredients under the right conditions, the recipe that is spider silk essentially cooks itself. Researchers still don't know enough about this process to fully recreate it. There are also many ways to spin spider silk, which varies between species and even within the same spider, Dr. Garb said. Although silks might be best known for their roles in web building, they can also be used to lure mates, protect eggs, or even help wayfaring spiders hitch a ride on a passing breeze. This study focused on the proteins found in dragline silk, which serves as a sort of bungee cord for spiders dangling from their webs or ceilings. Dr. Hayashi added, but there's still a lot more that nature has figured out that we don't know about.
Imagine you're living in one of the most impoverished countries in the world. You have no job, money, insurance, health system, clean water, nothing. And you don't know from where or when your next meal will come. Imagine your country is torn apart as a result of a bloody war, and the enemy is viciously targeting all civilian infrastructure, including the national grid. Without electricity, your country will regress to an age of darkness. The wheels of industry will come to a halt. Hospitals won't function properly, and everyday life will become a living hell. If you are in Yemen, you don't need to imagine yourself in all these horrible situations. You're already part of this human tragedy.
Thank you.
among endless problems induced by the war, long hours of power outages have created an invisible pain that runs through the whole country. The power cuts reach 8 hours a day, sometimes reaching 24 hours. It's like hell. We cannot sleep because of the high heat. We are living and dying in the dark. These are common sentences that can be heard in Yemeni's everyday conversation.
When you see that they attack electricity stations, power lines, power stations as well, and also blockade the oil industry and the oil imports that is so necessary for the fuel, for the electricity production in Yemen. One of the major reasons behind this is that they want to break Yemen's spirit. These are attacks that no longer target military goods, military or equipment or soldiers of the Yemeni Republic.
Power outages have left almost all major cities in the dark since the onset of the war in 2015. The Saudi-led coalition has destroyed many transmission lines, power stations, and other electricity facilities, crippling the country's critical center. Yemen's Ministry of Electricity says the coalition has targeted more than 5,000 power stations and other pieces of critical energy infrastructure, most of them away from any fighting or military site. According to the ministry, 90% of the total Yemeni population are living without electricity.
There have been several reports already that there are a lot of health centers. Reports speak about the majority of health centers and hospitals in Yemen having shut down due to a lack of power and due to a lack of fuel necessary to fuel their generators. And the same goes for institutions such as oxygen factories that produce necessary oxygen tanks and oxygen machinery and equipment in order to keep people alive during life-saving surgery.
In April 2016, Saudi warplanes destroyed the main power station in Taiz province. 4 months later, in August, they dropped bombs on two generating stations at Harav and Midi in Haja province. 8 bombs also targeted the main power station in Amran, destroying 2 transformers. The coalition had already bombed in July 2015 a compound housing employees of a power plant and their families, killing and injuring more than 300. Some families have reportedly pulled their children out of school to fetch water as electric pumps have become useless. And those students who still go to school cannot study without electricity when night comes. Needless to say, the surface water children and women fetch is often contaminated with cholera and other bacteria.
You have to bear in mind that take away a nation's electricity and you make them drop back decades, if not centuries, into the past. And whereas, of course, you can say, you know, in the past people survived as well, the sudden drawback, the sudden collapse that the sudden cutting of all power causes will immediately, and in the course of weeks and months even more, cause a mass amount of civilian deaths. This is basically unavoidable if you take such a drastic step as to cut off an entire nation's power for an extended period of time.
Meanwhile, a handful of factories that have survived the war are now closed down in the absence of electricity. Long-lasting power outages have been taking their toll on Yemeni patients whose lives are dependent on life-saving facilities.
When lengthy power outages occur and the emergency backup generators may not always be enough to keep the power running for a long time in places such as hospitals, emergency centers, childcare services, factories that produce necessary medical and other equipment. So this has had a very intense direct result for thousands of people in Yemen who are suffering from medical conditions, people who have been wounded due to the bombings, for example, that Saudi Arabia has been carrying out in Yemen for years now.
Yemen's Public Electricity Corporation has estimated that the financial damage from these measured attacks on power infrastructure adds up to over $4 billion.
When they seek to destroy Yemen completely, this is their way of indeed reducing the country back to ashes, and then later on come back with some few billions of petrodollars to build up the country back as a Saudi puppet state, and then portray the money that they gave as an act of charity. This is a very typical Saudi strategy that we have seen in this region in particular.
Yemeni citizens now have to pay a monthly subscription fee of up to 350 to 400 Yemeni riyals to private sector producers. Many Yemeni families cannot afford it. Before the war, it was just 7 Yemeni riyals per kilowatt. Years of indiscriminate airstrikes and bombardments have destroyed the national grid and contaminated large areas across Yemen, including areas through which power lines pass, turning them into fields full of mines and unexploded bombs. In the words of Abdul Qadir Motahar, Director General of Transportation at the Electricity Corporation, "We have 490 electric towers in the Sana'a Marib line that passes through Nam, most of which are now destroyed or affected by the raids, shelling, and unexploded ordnance."
The blame for Western countries goes much further than merely selling weapons. Of course, when you sell weapons, I mean, my native country of Belgium has recently ceased selling weapons directly to much of the Saudi military, but not all, I believe. But before that, the Belgian government always said, like, we sell these weapons to the Saudis. What they do with it afterwards is not exactly our fault. You know, that is, they try to kind of turn around a little bit and shift the blame away that way. But the blame goes much further than that, especially in countries like the United Kingdom and the United States. They don't just sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, but they are directly involved in intelligence services. There are American and British forces and Israeli forces and experts directly present in the war rooms of the Saudi-led coalition.
The Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center says the dense amount of mines and unexploded ordnance that are now spread near electric transmission lines is huge. It'll take a long time before teams are able to reach them to start the rebuilding process. It is clear that a poor country like Yemen, which cannot secure even the basic staples of life, cannot get rid of these huge amounts of unexploded remnants and landmines in the near future. With the help of Ansarullah, Yemeni citizens have just started using solar energy. But the question is, will the Saudi-led coalition allow them to use it for a long time? And will light overcome darkness in the end?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.